This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is June 28th, 1993, and this is tape 40, side 2. We were talking about the special session of July 30th, 1984, and you wanted me to begin the session talking about NEC.
Yeah. NEC was the first company to announce of building a plant in Oregon. And their particular note, because they had done this before we repealed the unitary system of taxation. Mm-hmm. Now, it should be noted that the Japanese had companies here for many, many years. And we had even the Bank of Tokyo here. This is all prior to what we start talking about NEC and Fujitsu and some of the other companies, Epson. But the difference here was a company that came in, made a capital investment, actually developed a business and to hire people. Mm-hmm. The companies that had been here were trading companies, mostly buying wheat, buying logs and lumber, and so they were trading companies. They had their offices and that was it. But here was a company coming in to build a plant and hire Oregonians. And the reason I make particular note of NEC, there was a real push on in Japan for states that had the unitary system of taxation to get rid of it. And although, well, there may even have been some kind of an unspoken deal, we're not going to do business with those states to sort of apply pressure. But NEC, and they're a very large company in Japan, they broke from that. So I consider that, you know, knowing Japan and how these people operate, that was quite a thing for a major company to break from that. We spent a lot of time with them. We spent a lot of time with the Department of Revenue. And they knew that I was going to try to get rid of the unitary system of taxes, but I had not yet done it. And so this still was an undefined future. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to show them how they could organize to at least for three, four years maybe to avoid the possibility of a unitary system of taxation. And so I'm really very happy about that whole thing. And I always like to mention that specifically because I call them our pioneers. They're the ones that really did it. And when a big company like that announces for a state like Oregon, all that whole business community is in Oregon. You know, let's find out about Oregon. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a signal event. After that, and we'll get into it, we had other companies announce, mm-hmm. Fujitsu, America Microelectronic, and then Epson, Seiko Epson.
But you called the special session, didn't you, in 1984?
Yes.
For that purpose.
For that purpose.
What kind of effort did you do to prepare yourself for that session?
Well, of course, and we talked about earlier, you know, specifically how I wanted to do that. We discussed that, and it took a period of time. In the meantime, there was a lot of public news about the unitary system of taxation. Mm-hmm. A lot of people didn't really know what it was all about. They knew it wasn't good in terms of economic development. And so there was a lot of external, the media said it ought to happen, you know, and mm-hmm. And there was different people that talked about it was not good, we ought to get rid of it. So there was kind of a external preparation out there. And I mentioned to you about Morita with his press conference, and I said, no, just keep it up. Everything is, you're doing just well. And so all of that. Then I said, okay, I've got this bill all figured out, and I want to call you to get rid of the unitary system of tax. That basically fundamentally was it. So they didn't come as a total mystery about what, you know. Already they understood, they may not have known exactly what it was, I'm talking about the legislators now, but they also knew it wasn't good and it had something to do with economic development. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was the advantage I had. I mentioned to you before that with knowledge, I called a special session rather than wait till the regular session. Well, one, of course, was the reason I mentioned. I wanted to make sure we got rid of it, so that the report that Morita was going to publish indicated that. But beyond that, I didn't want to mix up with budget or anything else. I wanted just to look at that subject. And I also knew they were running for office, and I knew they had to be for economic development, even if they didn't understand what that meant. So it was just sort of a little connivory going on in my mind.
Did you work with legislators prior to the special session to try to build a consensus?
Well, basically with leadership. I don't really meet with all of the legislators, but you meet with the president and the speaker, and meet with the Republican leaders. Mm-hmm. And have to get agreement on limiting a session. I think we talked earlier that once you call a special session, you're in session. Anything, it's just like any other session. So unless there's some agreement of controlling what's going to happen, you run a danger of a whole lot of things happening. Mm-hmm. And so you get that kind of an agreement. You review with them what it is you're doing and how you're doing it, and they convey to their caucuses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of taxes during this time, the legislature also voted to give a one-year tax break to Washington residents who work in Oregon. Apparently under a 1983 law, the household income, including Washington income, is used to determine the tax bracket for paying taxes on Oregon income. And in the past, only Oregon income was used to determine tax brackets.
That was one of those contentious things between mm-hmm. Oregon and Washington. And particularly Clark County, but not necessarily just Clark County. There's the most population. But the border cities and counties to Oregon. They were working in Oregon. It was convenient, just like it is for people in Vancouver come over here. We were taxing them at a higher rate than we were Oregonians. And so we didn't accomplish that during our regular session, and they were very upset. And I had promised Governor Spellman that the first time we had a session, and at that point when I first talked to him about it, didn't know exactly when, that I would deal with that subject. And I kept my promise. And again, the Speaker and the President and the Republican leaders were aware of the subject. They knew about it, so that was not something new either. Mm-hmm. So we got rid of it. In other words, we put them on the same level with the Oregonians.
Was there much of a fight against that?
No, not really.
Uh-huh. Well, as far as the special session goes, I mean, aside from the unitary tax, were there any other topics or?
No. There was, everybody's got an idea, they want to do something.
Right.
But that's this meeting with leadership. They just, mm-hmm. they create a rules committee, and that just takes care of it. Mm-hmm. And then the revenue committee that deals with the subject that we called them for.
Another thing that happened during that same time, which affected Oregon directly, was the Washington Public Power Supply System disaster.
Yes.
The largest municipal bond failure in American history. Could you give me a little background on that and what happened and how it was going to affect Oregon?
Well, in direct effect for Oregon, I suppose it would have been an effect out somewhere out there in the future. But the Washington Public Power System, I never did quite really understand. They were going to build 5 nuclear power plants. And I'm saying, remember we had this discussion, there's not going to be another nuclear power plant. How are they embarking on this huge project? 5, not one, but 5. I found that quite inconceivable that they were doing that. And in Washington, there's public utility districts, or people's PUDs.
Right.
They use both words, public and people's. And they had this consortium, and they were going to build these power plants. The only effect it might have been, obviously if they had 5 nuclear power plants, they might have power to sell. Mm-hmm. And there would be an excess of power, and Oregon might benefit by, they're on an intertie like everybody else, and there'd be plenty of power around for Washington and Oregon and who knows who else. With them not there, obviously, that gets us back to what we call a normal supply of power. other than outside of that, except for the investors, whoever they may have been, and I'm sure there was some Oregonians, that would have been a major effect, or not effect, because we didn't have it. But I never did. I could never figure it out. I went over there at one time, went to the reservation, saw I saw some partially built, one almost built. Got a lot of cement, pipe, and wire. But as we know, it never happened. And that was well known all over the United States. I have a cousin of mine that her husband is a lawyer in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. He knew. He was asking me about whoops. And so.
Yeah.
So it was pretty well known all around, but I how they even conceived of that, I don't know.
There were a lot of tragic stories about people who invested their entire retirement savings and whatnot into those plans. But the people that would pay for it immediately would be the ratepayers, isn't that right? They'd have to come up with that. How many billions of dollars? 20?
I don't know, but
it was a lot of money.
A lot.
And you were generally favorable to a special committee's recommendation to spread that cost of the two abandoned plants among all Northwest ratepayers.
Well, to the extent that would have been would have taken care of the bondholders, and it would have meant very little to everybody. I mean, each of us. That sort of made sense.
Mm-hmm. But it became to a 30-year surcharge, didn't it?
Yeah.
So I presume we're still paying for it.
Well, I'm not sure how much we're paying for it, meaning us ratepayers.
Yeah.
I think the ones that really paid for it were the bondholders that never got their money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said at the time that the investor-owned PGE company and PPNL could logically question why their customers should help pay for the abandoned WIPS plants when the utilities were denied relief for their investments in the terminated Pebble Springs nuclear project in Eastern Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a matter of being fair.
Mm-hmm. And so you didn't feel that it was fair for them to do it the way they did, or?
No, but you know, all you can do is express yourself.
Yeah, yeah. In April of 1984, you requested wilderness designation for a wilderness for a roadless area in the Willamette National Forest used by your family for a long time previous to that for gold mining and recreation for more than 50 years. That was the Opal Creek area, 50 miles east of Salem. We may have talked a little bit about this, but it was near the hidden wilderness proposed by Governor Senator Hatfield's Oregon Wilderness Bill. What could you tell me about that?
Well, first, I'm a little curious. I made sure that I really never directly got involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
My nephew George has been out there, and he's the one that. Well, we even read about him today. And he would come to me and I'd say, George, I don't want to get directly involved in this. That was a mine that my father-in-law owned.
And the Shining Rock? Was that the Shining Rock mine?
Well, it wasn't called Shining Rock. He had a lot of different names. He had different companies.
Uh-huh.
He went up there in 1929. That is my father-in-law. And in the latter years of his life, both he and my mother-in-law, they lived up there full time. Some were old mines that he rediscovered, some were tunnels that had been there. They'd been mining up there for a long, long time, long time. Basically, there was gold, silver, lead, copper. Let's see, gold, silver, lead. Anyway, and I'm sure there was some in there, and I would go in some tunnels, some of the old tunnels, and I really wouldn't mind it too much as long as I could see daylight. But once we took the first turn, this was never really one of my big deals going in these tunnels. We had those smelly carbide lights to go in there, There wasn't a great deal of interest as there is today. As a matter of fact, in the long history of it, my father-in-law at one time had a sawmill up there. I never saw the mill. It was disintegrated and gone by the time I started going up there, which was 44. I got married in 44. They also had an ore mill up there. And that had, by the time I'd gotten there, was pretty well snows and just disuse had fallen down. And anyway, he had, I'm trying to remember now, I think 163 claims. You'd go out and you'd stake a claim, and I've forgotten how big they are, but a claim is a certain size. And although this was public land, you didn't have surface rights, meaning trees mainly, but you did have the mineral rights. You could go in and have the mineral rights. That was permissible and still is today. Mm-hmm. And so he had all these tunnels, and he had, I don't know how many different companies. Shiny Rock is the latter-day name. That's something somebody else applied to it. And as he was growing older, my mother-in-law died, and I'd go up there and I'd help him. He had a flume line to bring water into camp to run the Pelton wheel for the electricity. And we'd have to patch up with tin cans the flume line, and I'd do a little bit, but I'd go there and I'd go fishing and I'd shoot my muzzleloaders and just have a nice, I'd have a vacation up there. It just got to be quite a burden. For me, and father-in-law was getting older, and I was really kind of managing whatever expenses he was getting, Social Security. And anyway, I sat him down one day, and I said, okay, now, I want to go through this whole thing, or put it on a piece of paper. Which company has which claims? And he'd made deals with some other people, and they would have some of the mineral rights, and he was going to apply for patents, and if patents mean then you could own the surface, which would be trees. Who had what piece of what, which probably was the best thing I ever did, because he did pass away. Everything was in his head, I finally put it on paper. So there was the Saniam Mining Company and Pacific Smelting and Refining Company, and I've forgotten the names, but they would have Bull Moose number one and Blue Jay and all that sort of thing. And anyway, I put it on a piece of paper. And then he passed away. You could retain those claims by doing assessment work. Mm-hmm. In those days, you didn't necessarily have to do, that was supposed to be $100 a claim. You didn't have to do it on each claim. You could do $200 on one claim and nothing on another. It just still comes out that way. And there was some monkeying around with that whole thing, and I was fooling around with it. And finally, I was getting tired of it. It was just something I didn't, wasn't that interested in it. The reason I think it never produced it was there. I'm sure it was all there. But there wasn't really enough of it that would pay to take it out, and the price wasn't high enough to anybody could make a profit on. I think that's probably why it never happened. And all of a sudden, these folks from Hawaii came and they were interested in buying it. Now, what they were really buying, they weren't buying much, they weren't buying anything, really. I was at the point I was just going to unlock the gate and throw the key away and forget it. But if I abandoned it, then someone would have to come back and restake the claims, 160 claims. Mm-hmm. If I sold it, they didn't have to do that. So we sold it. I don't know, $100,000 or something for everything. But that's like finding money in the street as far as I was concerned. Yeah. My wife got a third, and she has two sisters, and they got a third. Mm-hmm. Out of that came the Shiny Rock Mining Company. And then as time moves along, they were going to log Opal Creek, timber, and George gets to save Opal Creek. Opal Creek is one of the creeks that come down right near the main house, maybe two blocks away. And another creek comes down. I keep forgetting what that other one, but where they join, that is the beginning of the Little North Fork of the San Juan River.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, beautiful country up there. And I know everywhere. I mean, I've been fishing up there, and I go up the Opal Creek, and it's really wonderful, really very nice. Anyway, save Opal Creek, and now the Lake Nature Conservancy was going to take it. Some of it's already been given, or not to Nature Conservancy, but somebody else. And then I read in the paper where they'd give some of it back to the government. I don't know what he'd give back to the government. Some claims were patented right there at camp. But that's it. You said earlier that I was proposing. I tried to stay out of that whole thing. Because my wife and my family, my wife's family, they were all involved, and I shouldn't be a party to anything that goes on. So I said, George, I'm going to stay out of it.
Mm-hmm. But George was trying to get you involved in it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Was that difficult to?
No, I just told him, George, I just don't think it's proper for me to be getting involved. I'm not going to get involved with it. Mm-hmm. He kept trying to get me involved with it, and I said, no, George, I'm not going to do that. So it's just, you know, somebody might think this is some kind of a, you know, I had all the smell of a potential scandal, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that now. And my wife would have been very, very sad about it. She wasn't, you know, as she grew up, and Grandpa was, her father was always selling shares of this and that. Anyway, she didn't have particularly good feelings about the whole thing.
Where does it stand today? Opal Creek and the mines.
Well, there's a lot of people go up there. I think they even charge people to stay overnight. The main house burned down, and they rebuilt a real fancy main house up there. I've been there just once since we sold it, and it was after the main house burned down, and they built a new one. And I stayed there overnight, just once since we did sell it. I'm not exactly sure, you know, I guess I get George's book, or not George, somebody wrote a book on that subject, and it's been recently published. But some of it's back to the government, some of it's, I think the camp and that or surrounding area, they're ultimately maybe working towards Nature Conservancy owning it, I'm not sure, but that's pretty much it. I think the gift, it was a gift, these Hawaiian people, Twig Smith. Twig Smith was the owner of the Honolulu Advertiser, and the Twig Smith is one of the old families of Hawaii, one of those religious families that did well by doing good.
Right.
And they owned they created a Persis Corporation or Foundation or something, which was, I guess they were using. Hmm. Not directly corporate money, but some of the profits. But anyway, that's the thing they were doing. Mm-hmm. They bought a ski area over in New Hampshire or Connecticut or something. But the brothers, that's Twig Smith, and I think they're pretty well out of it, I think, by gift or whatever. They're out of it. But they're the ones that acquired it.
Well, in reference to Half-Hill's Wilderness bill, that was the center of a bitter political fight between Senator Hatfield and Senator James McClure of Idaho, also a Republican, who was the Energy Committee chairman at the time. And McClure had stalled Hatfield's bill in committee because he wants Hatfield's bill to follow his own Idaho wilderness bill on the release issue. That bill would prevent further wilderness studies by the Forest Service until the next century. Were you involved in that issue at all?
No. Incidentally, as an aside, we mentioned Willamette Week, there was some freelance writer, and he was going to write about the mine. and he came to interview me. And he looked like one of these expose kind of writers. But we answered his questions, and he was freelance. But after working, I think, a year or longer, he was trying to find some scandal. This is really what he was looking for. And finished his article, and I understand, although I wasn't close to it, that after all that period of time, and Willamette Week looked at it and figured it was just a non-story.
Right.
And it really was a non-story. He was just trying to make something that just wasn't there. So it was whatever his story was in the year he spent at it, he got nothing out of it.
But you did want 9,000 acres of the Opal Creek area set aside? Was that added to the proposed?
When you ask that question, I've never formally made a statement. I stayed out of it. I always wondered how they could harvest that and replant it. Having been up that Opal Creek Canyon, it's pretty steep. And that would have been my druthers.
It was to be added to the hidden wilderness.
It never did get quite to that point, but added to a wilderness or some provision that it would not be harvested. And that would have been my druthers, but I never took a position on it. By that I mean public position. Nor did even George know that's exactly how I felt about it. It's just that if there was some way to not harvest that, it would have been okay with me.
Mm-hmm. I think you referred to it as being a visual thing for you.
Yeah, I knew it intimately. I'd been up there. Matter of fact, one time my father-in-law, one of the fellows that worked for him, and a close friend of mine, and I, four of us, went up. We were going to hike to Opal Lake. And actually we lost the trail and spent a night up in the hills. I hit the lake that day, next morning, and got down there, and there were fish in that lake. That's what we were heading for. But you know, this was about Labor Day, and that lake had just been sitting there, and the fish had warmed, you know, warmed, and the fish was. We soon discovered that was not a very good deal. So instead of going back, you had to go up back to a very high bluff to get back to the trail. We decided we were going to walk down Opal Creek because we knew that went into camp. We left at 11 o'clock in the morning. We finally got back to camp at 8 o'clock that night. And I tell you, that I know that canyon very well. It's a rough canyon. Other than that, I would go up the creek from camp and fish maybe a mile and a half. So I knew it pretty well. Mm-hmm.